When the world seems out of hand, you can count on the StoryCorps podcast for your dose of humanity. Unscripted conversations between real people about the things that matter most. This season, 12 all-new episodes about reunions and what it means to connect at this moment in our nation's history. Episodes are available every Tuesday.
I'm Bob Boylan with All Songs Considered. Fifty years ago, just before the holidays in 1968, and I remember this well, the Beatles put out not just a new album, but a double album. The album art was simply a stark, white, glossy cover with raised, slanted lettering that simply said, The Beatles. That self-titled album, with its 30 songs spanning genres from American country music to avant-garde tape collage, has come to be known simply as the White Album. And in celebration of its birth 50 years ago, the Beatles label Apple Records has scoured the archives and has, for the first time, released early demo tapes, studio outtakes, and stunning remixes, both stereo and surround sound, of the entire album. Today, a conversation with the man who produced this 100-plus song celebration, Giles Martin. Giles' father, George Martin, produced the White Album, along with most everything else the Beatles ever did. You'll also hear some of the demo tapes, the outtakes, and some of the new remixes here. But first, Giles Martin describes the making of the White Album. It turned out to be a much less planned and more organic process than ever, and that frustrated George Martin.
The way he worked, the way he worked with the band, he was almost like an architect. So he had this ability to be able to have a blueprint to an album and build the album. That's what they did with Sgt. Pepper. Now, the White Album, the Beatles went, we don't need an architect. We're going to build this from the ground up. That's the way I think the White Album was built. The White Album was built brick by brick with no idea about what it was going to be like in the end. And for my father, who liked efficiency and liked organization, I mean, you know, my biggest fault with my dad was once when I mixed a drink and I didn't measure it, and he almost disowned me as a son. And that was essentially what the Beatles were doing with the White Album. And so he was kind of ostracized to a certain degree. And people think that the White Album was the four Beatles working as individuals, but it wasn't. It was the band taking over, and that's what we're going to hear. So they went to Rishikesh in India and they wrote songs. And don't forget, they were no longer touring. So before Sgt. Pepper, they were touring, and they toured for 4 years constantly. But they wrote demo songs. And the weird thing about the White Album is, it being band-driven, is they recorded demos for pretty much everything. And we discovered these demos, the Isha demos, that they'd had been bootlegged, but nothing, always bad quality. So Olivia Harrison, who's George Harrison's widow, had the original tapes. And they are the template that became the White Album.
Pick us one and paint a picture for us.
Well,
Isha is the estate, or?
Well, Isha's an area. Isha's where his house was.
George Harrison's house.
But I think they're called the Isha Demos. I got a feeling deep inside. I have a feeling that they weren't all recorded at George's house. I think that they were compiled there. But I got a feeling, just because the room sound is different, that Paul, John, and George all had four-track tape machines, and I think they made their own demos, but I think the other Beatles were present. So I'll play you a bit of Back in the USSR. And what you hear is, you hear Paul twice. They all Isha demos of them double-tracking themselves, which means they're singing the same thing twice. They're not in perfect sync. But you can hear other Beatles in the background. You hear tambourines and percussion.
So it's not like they had their own machine in their own home and they did their thing and then they brought it to the band. There are other members of the band here.
Here we are. Just have a listen. You can hear other people in the background.
Hey, Mel. Flew in from Miami Beach, BOAC. Didn't get to bed last night. On the way, the paperback was on my knee. Man, I had an awful flight. I'm back in the USSR. You don't know how lucky you are, boy. Back in the USSR. Been away so long I hardly knew the place. Gee, it's good to be back home. Leave it till tomorrow to unpack my case. Honey, disconnect the phone. I'm back in the USSR. You don't know how lucky you are, boy. back in the U.S., back in the U.S., back in the U.S.S.R.
Well, the Ukraine girls really knocked me out. They leave the West behind. My soul girl make me sing and shout. That Georgia's always on my mind, my mind, my mind, my mind, my mind.
Pretty playful. Do we know who's doing what, or is there no documentation about what's going on? We obviously know it's Paul on the
There's no documentation
guitar.
At all. Yeah. I mean, they weren't. These aren't meant to be. These are their demos, and if you think about the way the Beatles used to work, is you know mainly John and Paul, and later more George, would come to the studios and play the song. And for this, you know, technology moved on, and they started recording, making their own demos. And
which is how so much music now gets made. And this is 50 years ago, the beginning of home recording.
Well, if you think of the White Album, for enough, it became a template for a lot of the way records are made. I mean,
how so?
Well, I think you know, for my father, for instance, it wasn't his favorite album because the Beatles demanded different hours. I mean, it's almost like the way they started sessions moved on 2 hours every year. So by the time we got to the White Album, they were starting at 11 p.m. and finished at 6 in the morning. Now, in the 70s and 80s, that's what bands did.
Yeah.
You know, we had Will.i.am at Abbey Road recently, and he started at 10:30, you know, at p.m. So that's the way things happen now. But in those days, in 1968, it was unheard of with a wife and a small kid. It was like, these aren't these sort of hours we work at Abbey Road. What's going on here? And it was a different environment, and they spent more hours in the studio. So the whole project became a template for the way bands work now.
What do you think it means when, instead of four people being in a room and working out tunes, what do you think it meant to the sound of the White Album that they could demo in a more personal, more relaxed environment? And in terms of songwriting, it feels like to me, and maybe I'm making more out of this than not, but it feels like to me that they were able to shape their own songs a little more, and they felt a little more individual on the White Album than they did in albums past.
Well, I think if we think about it, you know, we listen to the Isha demos, and that's Paul very much singing back in the USSR, and I think it's either George or John in the background clapping and singing, but they don't know the song completely, because otherwise they'd be singing, you know, they're a natural harmony, you know, would sing natural harmonies, lots of that. It's not as though, so it's a Paul-driven song in the same way that, you know, we could listen to Sexy Sage from Isha. It's a John-driven song. And so what it is there was still collaboration because this is a John song, but we're all going to play on it, opposed to it being a Beatles song. But that didn't mean there was necessarily fractiousness. So people think the White Album was the boys in different rooms of the studios going off and making their own records. It wasn't.
The contentiousness that often is talked about as the beginning for the White Album, as I hear these demos, it doesn't feel that way at all.
No, I think both John and George wrote things or said things about the White Album. They said a lot of things in the 70s about things anyway. I was playing back I Will yesterday to some people, and someone said, but I read that it was just Paul on his own. Who are the other people in the background having a laugh? I was like, well, that's, you know, that happens to be John and Ringo. But I read it was Paul on his own. You're going, well, it's not. You know, forget what you read, listen to the tapes. And that, I suppose that's been the most surprising thing for me on this project, is finding out that actually, you know, my dad always sort of grimaced when anyone said the White Album was their favorite album, because it wasn't a great experience for him. But I talked to Paul and Ringo, and they go, this was the band's record. You know, this is what it was. And I think you're exactly right. The sounds on it are created in a visceral way by the band, opposed to by production, if you like. You know, Loosen the Sky with Diamonds is created by the sound of that organ and the tambora and that sort of world and the delay on John's voice, where really the White Album, you don't get that. You get a much more, the sound is created by noise in a studios.
Let's give a listen to Sexy Sage. Let's hear John. And do we know anything else going on?
Well, the interesting thing about Sexy Sage, and I wish I found out, Sexy Sage was originally about the Maharishi.
Right, it was Maharishi. What have you done?
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I really hoped that there would be a version with John singing that.
And didn't find
and
that.
Didn't find it. So you just have to imagine it.
But okay.
Sexy Sage, what have you done? Made a fool of everyone. You made a fool of everyone. Sexy Sadie, oh, have you done? Sexy Sadie, you broke the rules, you laid it down for all to see. faded down for the sea. Sexy, oh, broke the rules. Sunny day of the world was waiting for the lover. She came along to turn on everyone. Sexy Sadie, she's the greatest of them all. Sexy Sadie, how did you know the world was waiting just for you? The world was waiting just for you. Sexy Sadie, oh, how did you know? Sexy Sadie,
I'm not sure if it's construction noise or... No, I'm just kidding.
But no, it's, I mean, someone's hitting a table, someone's having, someone's got a tambourine, someone's got a shaker. Yeah. And, you know, we don't know who it is.
Yeah. But we assume it's other Beatles. It's not...
It would be other
not house guests.
Yeah, it's not house guests. And you get the sense with the Isha demos, which is almost around the campfire.
Yeah.
Each one of them singing a song to the other. It's like, you know, this is what I've got, and what have you got? This is what I've got. And there was always, with the music, and especially with the music, there was always this unbelievable support mechanism within the Beatles. You know, all of the stuff that was said later, all of the stuff really in the studios is quite strong. That, you know, even, you know, a blockage like Oblidia Blada.
You say a blockage, what do you mean?
Well, they spent a long time recording it, and certain members of the band didn't like it. And that blockage was unblocked by John. You know, there's a great piano in Abbey Road called Mrs. Mills. It's kind of the sound of the Beatles. It's a very bright, tack mm-hmm. piano. And Paul told me that he was, you know, as usual, you know, in the studios early and with George and Ringo, and they were doing Oblidia Blada, and it was acoustic guitar, bass and drums, and John walks in and goes, "What are we doing, lads?" And they went, "Oblidia Blada." He was like, "Oh God." And he went to the piano.
Yeah.
I went, "Oh, here we are. And to take the mickey out of it, went ding, 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 ding. Paul went, "Oh, that's it. And, you know, so that's what I mean, is there was always this thing. And, you know, Ringo, you know, famously walked out of the White Album sessions. But I think, you know, he walked out because Paul was on the drum kit all the time. You know, he played drums on Dear Prudence.
Because Paul liked to tell him how to play a part, maybe.
It's always the thing. It's like, and when Ringo left, I think they realized that they were no longer the Beatles. The four corners of the square had been destroyed, and they needed that. And so they filled the studios with flowers when he came back. And, you know, Ringo talks about the White Album with a huge amount of affection. You know, he talks about when they did Yeah Blues, and they went to the anteroom of Studio 2 control room and all locked themselves in the room. Well, the machine room. So there's a small room at the back of the control room. They didn't go to the live area. They locked themselves in a cupboard, basically, and did Yeah Blues.
So they're tighter together.
So they're tighter together, yeah. I mean, now that's not a band breaking up to me.
When they took these demos, did they present them to George Martin? Did they present them to your dad? How did that work? Because, A, there's a ton of songs. They wrote an amazing amount of tunes.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I'll play another Isha demo quickly, which is Child of Nature. And I don't think they did. I think that presentation world had gone for them in a way. Huh. I think they cared deeply about what my dad thought. He was still part of the organization. You can hear outtakes where he's involved. But in essence, they wanted to record everything. So, and they had so many songs. I mean, you know, the White Album is 30 songs. Alongside that, during that time, they recorded Across the Universe. They recorded Lady Madonna. They recorded Hey Bulldog. They recorded Hey Jude. There was a bunch of George songs that weren't on the album, like Not Guilty and Circles. About during, and you can listen to it on the outtakes that we've released, is that during While My Guitar Gently Weeps with Eric Clapton on guitar, halfway through that session, Paul starts playing Let It Be. You know, so, I mean, I didn't even know he'd written Let It Be. You know, it was like they had two, they couldn't, no one could keep up in the studios with the number of songs they had, but they wanted to record everything. That's what changed.
They're how old, to remind people?
Well, they're, 27, 28.
Amazing,
you know,
right?
That's
mind-boggling.
Yeah, it's the thing. I mean, that's the motivation behind remixing for me, is that we live in a world, you know, I love the world of albums, I love the people who put albums, but there is a playlist world out there. And when someone puts on an Ed Sheeran track on a playlist next to Blackbird, kind of Paul and Ed are the same age, if you think about it. So music is timeless. So why can't they be next to each other? And just as relevant is my view. Mm-hmm. But I mean, here's an example. This is the Isha demo of a child of nature. Now, listeners will recognize this tune. And this didn't end up on the White Album because John wasn't happy with the lyrics and decided to change them. And he changed them to Jealous Guy.
On the road to Rishikesh, I was dreaming more or less, and the dream I had was true. Yes, the dream I had was true. I'm just a child of nature. I don't need much to set me free. I'm just a child of nature. I'm one of nature's children. Sunlight shining in my eyes.
I can't help but hear Jealous Guy there. I wonder if the fact that there was Mother Nature's son and just a child of nature was a little too much. Who knows, right?
Yeah, I wouldn't have thought that would be anything to stop John. I would have thought it's probably he probably, you know, they had great awareness, the Beatles.
Yeah.
And I'd have thought he knew that he could write a better lyric. And Jealous Guy's a better lyric.
Yeah, that's true.
Even though they had started writing separately, John and Paul, there was very much, you know, Paul had Hey Jude and played it to John, and that would be, I suppose that's what the dynamic changed in that way, where because they started running separately, they played it to each other first before they played it to my dad, perhaps, and played Hey Jude, and you know, your hand upon my shoulder, and he goes, well, don't worry, John, I will change that lyric, expecting the criticism from John. And John said, that's the best lyric in the song. You know.
That's friendship.
Exactly.
Let's hear this band in the studio. Is this Abbey Road where they're going to be? Because they did most of it in Abbey Road.
They did most of it at Abbey Road, yeah. They went to Trident, another studio, which had an 8-track. You know, so this is right on the cusp of technology. We're going from 4-track to 8-track. Dear Prudence, for instance, is an 8-track done in Trident. Hey Jude is done in Trident, in fact. But this is Abbey Road. I'll play a bit of Cry Baby Cry. It's just interesting. This is shows you, in fact, the Isha demo Cry Baby Cry is much closer to the version we know on the record. This is how the White Album was made. They went on a journey through sound, and this, in a funny way, reminds me a little bit of Pink Floyd, in a funny way.
Huh. I'll start again. Semolina, pilchard, greens, not pie, all mixed together with a dead dog's eye. 1, 2, 3, 4. Kitchen cooking breakfast for the Queen. The Queen was in the parlor playing piano for the children of the King. Cry, baby, cry. Make your mother sigh. She's old enough to know better. Cry, baby, cry. The king was in the garden picking flowers for a friend who came to play. The queen was in the playroom painting pictures for the children's holiday. Cry, baby, cry. She's old enough to know better, so cry, baby, cry. The Duchess of Kikori, always smiling and arriving late for tea. The Duke was having problems with the message at the local Burger King.
Remind us, who do you think is doing what here? Who's on the keys? You think it's Paul?
I was just thinking that. It's who's playing bass, the question. Paul playing bass. I think it must be George playing the guitar. George. And therefore, I think it's probably Paul playing organ. It could be John playing bass and singing at the same time.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of, it's, and this is the difference of the White Album, is that you can hear the fact they have that freedom. You have to remember that they lost their manager, Brian Epstein, the year before.
Right.
And my dad could have sort of, to a certain extent, felt he lost the classroom. They had a freedom. They were the Beatles. I mean, the thing about the Beatles is you've got to be aware, you know, my dad always used to say that the funny thing, the funniest thing about the boys is that they didn't really change much. They were the same arrogant bastards I first met them to begin with. that's what he used to say about the Beatles. And it's true, they had this foundation of confidence. You know, they wanted to be the biggest pop band in the world, and they became that. And then they wanted to be the most respected band in the world, and they became that. They had this force of nature. And with the White Album, they realized that they could experiment, they could afford to experiment in the studios, which didn't happen in bands in those days. No one could afford it.
There weren't that many studios.
Exactly, and they had the power. They were the Beatles. They had the power to take things over.
And they wore the heck out of engineers, I bet. I mean, the hours that they kept.
Yeah, and so that was an interesting. You know, Jeff Emmerich walked off the sessions, who was the engineer.
Is that early on? Or?
Yeah, reasonably early on. Reasonably early on, he'd had enough, you know.
Because the hours were crazy?
Well, they were sitting there at 3 a.m, and the band would be jamming, and there was not much interjection going on. There was not the conciseness. I mean, you think about Go Back to Paperback Writer, which is 66, with 1.5 takes.
Wow.
You know, 6680, 107 takes. You know, so there's the difference for you. And the narrowing down, it's not really a parts record, the White Album. And what I mean by that is, if you look at the Beatles, the guitar parts, for instance, I mean, take Abbey Road later on, it really is. It's the guitar parts, you know, whether it's Come Together or You Never Give Me Your Money, everything is in place.
What's more like orchestrated, I guess, is
correct,
the word.
That, correct, right. And earlier on as well, planned. You know, Drive My Car, Ticket to Ride, these riff, you know, I Feel Fine, they're very much a part, you know, very efficient songs where you take the version of Cry Baby Cry, it's like, let's just play. And I think that's from not playing live. This is the time when they played live. This is the only time they got together. You have to think about that. But before, previously, they were together all the time playing live. And so this was them discovering their instruments, if you like.
Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back. I'm talking with Giles Martin about the making of the Beatles' White Album, and you're listening to All Songs Considered from NPR Music.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, the Lagunitas Brewing Company. Founder Tony McGee says that learning to brew craft beer took inspired amateurism.
It's like punk music. They just picked things up and they said, if I can make this thing make noise, I can do it in rhythm and people will dance and we will fill up rooms with people angry as we are. And so it was with craft brewing.
To discover how music plays a part in more than just great beer at Lagunitas, visit lagunitas.com/music. Support also comes from ELS Studio 3D Premium Audio, available in the all-new 2019 Acura RDX. Surrounded by 16 speakers and 710 watts, ELS Studio 3D lets you take studio-quality sound on the road. Developed with 8-time Grammy Award-winning recording engineer Elliot Shiner, it's a whole new dimension in sound that lets you hear the music the way it was originally intended to be heard. Precision-crafted audio performance, exclusively from Acura.
I'm Bob Boylan. I'm here with Giles Martin. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of the White Album, some of the new mixes, the demo tapes, the outtakes.
I wish we had more time together. I mean, there are 50 outtakes, you know, we went through every single tape.
Let's quickly just stop and just describe what is in this package.
So in essence, I mean, listen, I have an incredibly privileged life where I have the keys to the door that opens up the Beatles universe. Mm-hmm. And I'm aware of the fact that it certainly helps being the son of George Martin. And I'm incredibly humbled to have, you know, Ringo and Paul and also Olivia and Yoko's trust that I'm able to do this stuff. And what I try and do is open up that door and get the world to be able to listen in the same way with the same excitement. And the Beatles universe is so rich. It's not a question of just, you know, reproducing an ashtray and selling it. There's depth to what we do. And with this, there are 27 Isha demos, which we'd heard a few. They're just acoustic mapping of the White Album. There are 50 outtakes. I mean, there could have been more. I said to the problem is some of them long. I mean, there's a version of Helter Skelter, which is 13 minutes long. There's a version of Revolution Number One. I mean, I said to the Beatles and the Rec, I said, how many CDs are we going to make? And they went, how many songs do you want to put on? I mean, it's like, you know, you have to stop somewhere. You do have to, you know, there are certain people in the world that would want to hear 107 takes for Sexy Sadie. You know, that exists. So there is this very rich vein, and it's hard. I mean, there are a few versions of While My Guitar Gently Weeps, and that was an interesting time because John and Paul definitely were in a cahoots, as they were a lot of the time with the White Album. And I think Ringo and George sometimes felt ostracized in this. You know, they would go and make records on their own occasionally. George had really developed as a songwriter. You know, he had songs. I mean, he had All Things Must Pass while during the Let It Be sessions. You know, if you think about what's happening next year in Beatles world, you know, there's Here Comes the Sun, Something on Abbey Road, and Here Comes the Sun is one of the most popular Beatles songs of all time. While My Guitar Gently Weeps is up there with the best Beatles songs. Yeah. And I think Eric Clapton was his best friend. And I think he asked Eric to come to the sessions because it was like, listen, guys, Eric Clapton's my best friend. He's the best guitarist in the world. If he thinks I'm good, surely you guys. You know, I think there's an element of that with this. And what people don't realize is that Eric didn't come in and do an overdub. Eric came and recorded one, and they was there for the whole session. So we'll play, and it gives you some sense. And so what you have on this version is there's no John. I think John was there, but he wasn't playing.
Okay.
He played the bass on While My Guitar Gently Weeps.
For the final take.
For the final take, yeah. There's a sort of chugging, there's a ding, 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 which is a six-string bit. Paul is playing piano and organ and singing. And then you have Ringo playing drums and George playing acoustic guitar and Eric on lead guitar.
And just quick picture painting here, because often people think in studio recordings, everybody's doing a part, and then they'll do an overdub, and then they'll do and build on it. But the White Album sessions were much more the band playing together. So when you say that, they're in the room and they're playing.
You'll hear them in the room. They're all in the room together. Paul's on piano, Eric's playing electric guitar, George's playing acoustic guitar, and Ringo's on drums. And here you are. This is the session.
I'll just have cheese and lettuce and Marmite sandwich and coffee. Okay, a 1, 2, 3, 4.
Hold it, Harry.
So it's okay. I sang, tried to do a smoky, and I just aren't smoky.
Smokey Robinson, I assume he's alluding to. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I think John's actually playing organ there. Huh. But yeah, it just shows the feel of that. I mean, that's take 27.
We're close to the final.
Close to the final, yeah. And George is obviously singing live and playing acoustic guitar, which is what they did. I mean, that's the thing about the Beatles. They did it. The overdubs, you know, a lot of it's live, and you get a sense of it doesn't sound like a band falling apart. Put it
sure
that way.
Yeah.
You know, it's that thing. There's that, and there's an incredible sort of contribution from Paul. Really, you hear on the sessions. You know, there's another version of that we have. Where you know they play it and he goes and Let It Be, and then they play this version, and then obviously we've mixed the master version. But you get a sense of what's beautiful about it. You get the sense of what it's like to be there. You know, it feels like you and I are sitting in a studio, talking to each other, but through the glass could be the Beatles, and that's what I try and get. You know, that's what I try and get people to hear.
An aside maybe, these takes, are these two-track live mixes or are these mixed by you as well?
These are mixed by me. Okay. But they're mixed by me. Actually, the approach is very different.
Yeah.
Myself and a wonderful engineer go and we remix Beatles stuff. With all of the outtakes, the way it works is I just sit. Sometimes I have a studios, I have a farm down in the Cotswolds, and mm-hmm. I have a studios down there in a room in a cottage, funny enough. And I'll sit and I'll remix all of this, all of the outtakes and these things. I mix on my own. I just sit there, but I try and do it in a way so they're really. I try and mix them so you can just hear everything. So it's like listening to the tape, as opposed to putting any effects. I don't put any plate reverbs or anything on. I just
you're not
try
polishing
and keep it.
Them. You're
I don't try and polish them. I just try and.
It's as if you were in the room.
Yeah, exactly. That's. Yeah. I'm just trying to get you to hear what's on the tape. They sound good because, you know, Ken Scott and Chris Thomas, who were both 21, and my dad brought them in on this project.
Unbelievable.
They were working on it, and they were gee, I mean, Ken Scott, just for your listeners, went on to go and make Transformer by Lou Reed and Hunky Dory with David Bowie, sure. And Chris Thomas ended up producing the Sex Pistols, the Pretenders, Elton John, INXS, Pulp, you know.
Roxy Music?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of great records.
So then your attitude, we're going to play a couple of remixes, and we did this last year with Sgt. Pepper. The big question everyone asks is, why do this? In making the segue from these multiple takes to the final remixes, what are you going for? I think it'll be the answer to this question will help answer the question, why do this? It'll also be try to get in your head as to what you're aiming for. Pretty great album. What are you trying to do for the listener?
Why do it is a really good question. I mean, I get asked by the Beatles and I get asked by fans to begin with, but what's the motivation? The motivation is I hate the idea. For people who've never heard the Beatles, they won't listen to them because they think they're an old band, and I have this strong belief that music doesn't become old. It's a time capsule. You know, the Beatles are 26, 27, 28 when they're recording this, and they'll always be that age. Mm-hmm. And we live in a world even more so now with streaming where, you know, music is timeless. People have playlists and they put records on it. And I want to make sure that, you know, when Hozier comes on and we listen to Yeah Blues, that they're the same kind of age, to be honest. Mm-hmm. They'll always be that age, you know, when they record it. I mean, you know, it's an interesting fact. And I think you can time travel in music, and that's the beauty of it. So, you know, we have the ability to be able to do things the Beatles couldn't have done and we think they may have done. It's a huge business. But I worked with my father for all my life. So when I was 15 in studios. Mm-hmm. I've made an album with Paul McCartney. I've done a Martin Scorsese film on George Harrison. I've gone deep, and I talked to Ringo. You know, so there is that presumption. I know Chris Thomas very well. I know Ken Scott very well. I mean, things like, you know, I'll play you Dear Prudence. Now, Dear Prudence to me is all about the guitar to begin with, that arpeggiated guitar. Yeah. In the original, actually, it's not how you think it is. The music's never how you think it is. And so we ADT'd it, which is what the Beatles did. It's artificial double tracking. We create a stereo sound out of a mono. And it makes it sound a little bit more beautiful. Mm-hmm. And then when John's voice comes in, it's stronger over the guitar, and then the bass sounds deep and the drums sound deep. And you, in a way, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to get you closer to the band. So I'm also peeling off the layers of compression that was on there. I don't have to worry so much about the needle jumping out of the groove as they did in 1968.
To help people understand that, everybody listen to music on albums.
Yeah.
If there was too much of bass or something, it would make your record player skip.
That's
and
right.
So there were compromises that had to be made to the reproduction, not to the actual recording of the stuff, because the recording was...
And despite what people think, is that the worst we listen to now is much better than the worst we listened to then.
That's right.
You know, no one listens. I mean, if anyone listens to on a pair of 1968 speakers, then congratulations. but I don't think that's the case. So there is that. But the most important thing for me is not to ruin the essence of what the song is. It's not about hi-fi. You know, we fill it, our ears fill in the blanks anyway. You know, the good old dirt and rock and roll, we never clean anything, for instance. You need that. It's an emotional engagement. Mm-hmm. So we mixed the White Album first, and actually we tore it apart, and we went and redid it again because the first mix was too compressed. It was too much like the original. Mm-hmm. And it's the shortcut to the White Album is just to make everything really super loud and compressed and stick it in a box. The White Album's a kind of an angry, visceral record. I thought, what would be more fun if we didn't do that? Let's just open it out a bit more, but then still have the aggression there. How do we do that? And so, you know, if you listen to Long, the mix off the White Album that we do now, Ringo told me, he said, you know, I remember being in the band in the room with George, and we played it. I think, okay, let's get the listener to feel that. It's hugely inspirational for me to work with them.
Awesome. So let's listen to.
So this is Dear Prudence, and you'll hear the openness. You'll hear to most of your listeners, it should just sound like Dear Prudence. Someone will say to me, oh, the drums and bass sound so much bigger. And then someone goes, and I'm thinking, oh my God, the drums and bass are too loud. And then someone goes, John's voice sounds great. And I go, well, that's a good thing. Maybe it's too loud. Then someone goes, what I can really hear is the backing vocals. And you go, okay, maybe I'm getting somewhere. So here we are.
One of my favorite bass lines ever, and it's got such a beautiful placement in this mix, and that background vocals that were always there, but
well, yeah, what we can do now is we can have them in stereo, so that, you know, in at one stage, you know, if you listen to the, you know, the stereo, the back vocals on one side, and that, you know, round, round, round should be around you. Mm. You know, I think, and I, you know, I have to take terrible, you know, have huge presumption, and that's what the Beatles would have wanted to do.
But they've listened. I mean, Paul and Ringo have heard these. It's not
absolutely. Yeah, you know, they are my bosses. Yeah. They've heard them, and if they didn't like them, we wouldn't be listening to them now. It's as simple as that. And that's the biggest kick I get, is actually playing them the mixes. And you know, they are the Beatles. I mean, there's only four of them, and sadly, there's only two of them left. And, you know, as Paul says, there was only four of us. Only we knew what happened. And Dear Prudence is an amazing track that, you know, that you can fall into. You know, that's what I love about this music, is you can fall into it.
Let's go out on one more thing.
Well, this is an interesting. I'll play you Paul's Birthday. The interesting thing about Birthday is it was written on the spot. There's no demo for Birthday, because he had an idea, let's do a birthday song and let's write it, and they created it in the studio.
Was it anybody's birthday, do we know?
No, I don't think so. I think it's one of those. Actually, someone asked me a really good question the other day. He goes, how come the Beatles never did a Christmas song? And it's right, they didn't do it. They did Christmas records.
Christmas time is but here again.
Yeah,
they did that, the Christmas records.
But that was it. They never did a Christmas song. I mean, they did. But the thing is, I mean, obviously, they wrote to a brief. I mean, All You Need Is Love was written to a brief, and Across the Universe was written to a brief. Right. It's funny how John got those, you know, where Paul was more commercial in lots of ways. Anyway, Birthday wasn't written to a brief, but you know, Paul does it concerts now and says, you know, this is for anyone who has a birthday this year. It's fun. I mean, you know, everyone says about, you know, Yoko being present during the White Album and how it destroyed the White Album, which isn't true.
And the part about that being true, that she didn't destroy the White Album.
Yeah, I mean, she was there, yeah. But I mean, this has a bunch of wives on it, which you can hear now.
By the way, you mentioned Revolution Number 9 in a presentation you gave yesterday in the 5.1 version that is on this packaging that you said.
Yeah,
was pretty
so listen, I love doing surround mixing. I think people talk about high def, et cetera, et cetera. I think actually, in a way, immersive audio is more thrilling for me. Mm-hmm. I think there's more of an upscale and change in that. And we did a surround mix of Revolution Number 9, which is very scary, you know, to leave the lights on when you listen to it. It's worth listening to. And it kind of makes sense of the song in a funny way, or the piece of music, because it's, you know, there's the famous Carnival Light, which is an unreleased Beatles track, a lot like Revolution Number 9, which was used for an exhibition at the Roundhouse. And I think it's almost Revolution Number 9 should surround you, and the voices should get bigger and smaller, and it should be slightly, you know, otherworldly, it seems like that anyway. So once you expand into a three-dimensional universe, which you can do with surround, mm-hmm. it becomes something else, and it's really worth listening to.
That's great. So we'll go out on Birthday. Last year we did Sgt. Pepper, and this year we did the White Album, and I hope we make this an annual event.
Well, I hope so. I mean, in all honesty, there's no plans. Right now I'm working on a film project, but, you know, it's always great to spend time with you. Thank you so
Thank
much,
you.
Bob.
Yeah,
Thank
a pleasure. You. Cheers. Giles Martin, the producer of this huge celebration of the Beatles' self-titled album, referred to as the White Album. This big celebration is out now. And if you want to go backwards in the archives, you can hear our conversation last year about the Sgt. Pepper remixes. I'm Bob Boylan for NPR Music. It's All Songs Considered.